Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
I had some joints and then my wife, I went out of town and my wife hid my joints so that our sons would not find the joints. And when I was looking for my fancy tape recorder, I keep it in this case. I was like, something smells like joints. And this is where she hid the joints and forgot that she hid my joints. I found my joints.
All right. Yay. Everything. Oh my God. See, this is such a happy reason to do a podcast now.
That's worth the price of admission right there.
Thank God your sons don't want a podcast. Let's put this where the podcasting machines are. They'll never find. You know, one time my son, his room was in the front of the house. And it's an old house, and like the mail slot would come through into like a cabinet built in his room. So, you know, like everybody had to go into his room to get the mail. And he and his boyfriend are laying in bed one morning, and I just kind of poke my head in because they're asleep to get the mail. Yeah. And right in front of where the mail slot is a gigantic bag of weed. It looked like a half ounce to me. And I just was like, he was awake and I was like, just pretend to be intimidated by me. Pretend to be afraid of me. You know, like, don't leave it in the only place in the room where I have to go, you know?
Yeah. But isn't it better than secrets?
I'm just kidding. Absolutely. I mean, no. And I mean, also too, my parents, you know, they didn't impose hypocrisy, you know. So it's like, my parents drank like fish. Well, like when they were teenagers, they drank cocktails. They didn't drink beer. They were drinking like Manhattans and Rob Roy's and shit I don't even know how to make. And so like when my brother and I got, they're like, yeah, drink beer. Just, you know, be careful. If your friends are too drunk, they can't go home, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So.
Yeah.
All right. On a podcast. Hi, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Does it bother you that I'm like unshowered?
No, not at all. I can't see.
It doesn't matter because really this is about the audio. No one's ever going to see my bed head.
No. I make the bed just for you. Like the bed that's behind me. I made it for you. Not for I don't care about these people. They're not going to see this.
Are we already recording? Because I feel like I'm way behind. Okay, now I'm recording now. So I'm also recording our podcast.
All right, then we got the first part covered. This is, I'm talking to Jack Black, if you haven't figured it out already. This is the three questions, this is the thing is like, why does anyone intro their podcast? People know. It's not like you stumbled on this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no randomly stumbling on a podcast. So anyway, people know. It's the three questions. It's Jack Black. And all right, tell me about your COVID, because I'll tell you about my COVID.
I'll tell you. I got the COVID a few months ago, and it was perfect timing, actually, because and where did I get it? Where did I suspect that I got it? It just was really mysterious. I don't know how or who gave it to me.
Yeah.
But, I went down hard. It was just like a nasty flu cold. Yeah. And I was down in my man cave, feeling sick, but thinking, I think this is just a flu or just a bad cold. I don't think it's COVID because I tested negative when I first felt symptoms.
Yeah.
But then I was like, just to be safe, I'm gonna test again. And that next test was two shiny red lines. And I was like, I'm gonna stay down here. Luckily, you know, we have a basement. I have my man cave den. I don't know what people do if they're living in, you know, a place without a separate, you know, place to go. So I actually weirdly enjoyed my COVID times because even though I was kind of sick, I got to sleep. I got to sleep as much as I wanted during my isolation, which is such a special luxury that I don't enjoy.
It's also the main thing you can do to get better. Like it's the best thing to do to get better. It's just, and that's what I did. If I felt like sleeping, I slept like 12 hours a day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would actually force myself to get sleep by taking, you know, over the counter, like Theraflu. And it would give me a little extra snoozleberry pie.
Yeah. Right. Just half a bottle of NyQuil. Good.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's what the kids do, right? NyQuil, you mix it with a little schnapps, and then you can go out on the town. COVID, man. No, I kept it safe underground. Yeah. And I just snoozed and I watched whatever I wanted. I got caught up on a few shows that I had fallen behind because now there's so many shows that I hear are great. I haven't watched any of them. Who's got time to watch shows?
I know. And also, too, and then I can't remember them. I'm like, I actually have written down some, like kept a list, like shows are fucking homework now, you know?
Yeah.
So I can remember because there's so many times when I'm like, okay, I don't have anything to watch. Let's watch. Oh, yeah. What was that one with the guy about the murder? And then I don't remember what it is. I don't know where it is, you know?
Yeah, and people tell me about new shows that I need to watch, and I nod my head like, ooh, that sounds like a good one. But in my mind, I know I'm never going to watch that show.
Right, absolutely. COVID. How many days were you down in the basement?
10 days.
Wow.
I mean, truth be told.
Did you see daylight at all?
Oh, yeah, no, I would sneak out. I would sneak out and get a little sunshine and fresh air. Every day, I think it's actually important. You got to get that sunshine and fresh air.
Yeah.
You know, just steered clear, let everyone know that I was coming and the coast was clear. And then I would come out, you know, COVID man, carrying a full viral load. But after about 5 days, just between you and me, I was starting to feel pretty good. And I was like, you know, I think I'm probably no longer contagious, but just to be safe, I'm going to stay in my awesome man cave and watch, you know, all the back seasons of Better Call Saul.
Right. Gotta do it.
And what else did I watch? I watched some rad things. I just enjoyed.
Yeah.
I'd like to get it more often. Check out this Andy Warhol Diaries show on Netflix.
Okay.
It's a series, and it just, like, gives you the inside scoop on Andy Warhol's genius and just a strange creature of this universe that needs to be studied.
Yeah. See, that...
I've been enjoying that.
I'll watch that one. I just started last night. I think it's an FX series, Jeff Bridges, called The Old Man.
And oh, yeah. I heard that was great.
I'd heard about it. And like, first of all, the name is off-putting. Like, aren't there enough fucking old men? And then, but then I find out it's like about, and it's just like that perfect thing of like, he's a CIA, like mega killer. Who like got out of the game and has been hiding, but they come for him. So he has to fight back. So it's like such like right up the alley. And I guess I'm like getting into the demographic of like, you know, old white man revenge fantasy, like that you can sit home and like, a lot of people have fucked me over too. I wish I was a ninja, you know? But it's really good. I mean, and there is like just a lot of that. I will never not watch things about, you know, that are like, you know, I have a
particular set of skills, like that kind of thing.
The Liam Neeson.
That shit is always like, oh my God, to have a particular set of skills would be so awesome. But the thing that drives me crazy, and it started a few movies ago, I don't know what, and he's so good, but Jeff Bridges now in everything sounds like he is having problems with his dental work. Have you noticed that? It's like, well, everything is like it's going his tongue and aura.
Yes.
And like in that, it was an awesome version of the Rooster Coburn, the Western with Matt Damon. I can't think of the name.
You're talking about, was this
the remake of the John Wayne, Glenn Campbell?
Yes.
You know,
and it's called Tim Larry.
True Grit.
Thank you.
It's called True Grit.
I knew there was a T.
He's so fucking great in that, but he sounds like he has three lozenges in his mouth the entire time.
Well, the whole time on that one, you're thinking, this is a character choice. He's choosing to talk. But then three movies later, you're like, oh, wait, it's not a choice. He's got marble mouth McClanahan. When did he get marble mouth McClanahan?
Stella Marble Mouth Adler School.
Somewhere right before True Grit.
I know. It's weird.
He was afflicted.
Yep.
I think it might have something to do with no, I actually don't say. I'm not going to say what it might. I'm not going to make a joke about the marble mouth because any minute now I'm going to have marble mouth McClanahan disease as well.
I hope not.
But I do love me some Jeff Bridges.
Oh,
and
he's fantastic.
At the end of the day, it goes back to the dude.
Yeah.
In whatchamacallit.
Yeah. Big Lebowski.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oh my God, I thought your internet froze, but you just froze so perfectly.
No, I was having an extreme case of brain fog.
Yeah.
This episode should be called Three Questions in the Fog.
Well, I loved him too, all the way back to was it Thunderball and Lightfoot or Thunderbolt and Lightfoot? You know, that bank
I didn't see that one.
It's like him and Clint Eastwood on a bank heist movie.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like really young. And spoiler alert, he dies of like a terrible brain injury. But
was that before Tron?
Yes. Yeah, it was
dang,
early
dude.
70s. Yeah.
Because me,
was
it felt like
Starman and, you know.
I think Tron was before Starman though, right?
I don't know.
It was around the same time. Starman, he crushed Starman.
Yeah.
He was just an alien without any real emotions or anything,
right.
But it was so emotional. I remember just bawling at Starman.
Yeah.
Because he was such a kind creature from another part of the galaxy.
Yeah. And who can't relate to that? All right. Tron was 82 and Starman was 84. You were right.
Yeah.
Tron
correct.
Was prior.
No.
Yeah.
I know that because I can trace it back to my gaming days in 82 at Westworld when I needed to play that Tron video game, as well as Discs of Tron. I was all about that in my youth.
Discs of Tron, yeah.
That was like the souped up Tron video game.
Well, how are you these days?
I could talk about
podcast.
Jeff Bridges the whole hour. I could because I marvel at his powers and his genius.
Yeah, he is pretty amazing.
I'm doing well. I'm in a pretty good space in my life right now. I'm enjoying listening to audiobooks. That's my new jam.
Yeah, me too. I've been listening too.
Because I
not
all the
about,
time
about reading, but I then I do feel like, well, I'm listening to a book, and isn't that sort of like reading? I mean, isn't it? Isn't
I'm going to say it's 100% reading.
Okay,
even though my son says, you're not reading. I was like, I just read a book. He said, did you read it or did you listen to it? I said, I listened to it. Then you didn't read it. And I was like, you know, this technicality, here's what we'll do. You read a book and I'll listen to it. And then afterwards, we'll take a test and see who retained more of the book.
Yeah.
Because what is it?
Yeah, it's fuck that guy.
A story, whether you hear it told to you or you read it on a page, same diff.
I'm sure I'm sure that there's some like, you know, neurological studies about the difference, but my attention span is so fucking shitty that it's really hard for me to read.
Dude, me too.
It's really
hard. Is it because of brain fog or was it happening before the brain fog?
It was, for me, it was like,
It's just attention deficit. It's just pretty yes. heavy attention deficit. And I can do it. I can read books that are, and you know, and this is the thing about ADD, that if I didn't have ADD, I would smell a rat. Cause it's like, if I'm really into it, I can focus on it. That just sounds like, well, you're just a baby. You know, like you're just like a big full diapered baby. Like, oh, if you're not interested, you can't focus. Boo hoo. But it's true. Like I can read like a book that's like all plot and all action and, you know, or about a topic that I'm really into. But if it's like a novel that's about like a family struggles, you know, in, you know, 1950s New England. Z, that's the sound of me sleeping. Good night. I cannot stick to it. It just, I end up like really feeling like it's like, I don't have a lot of trouble sleeping, but when I do, I read a boring book and then it's like, it puts me right the fuck out, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I have that too, to a degree. And I can tell pretty quickly if I'm reading a book that I just don't like, and I have to be honest with myself, it's not my ADHD. It's that this book does not agree with my, you know, sensibilities. It's just not my cup of, but even stuff that I like, I have a hard time not wandering to another subject in my mind.
Right.
And even so, that's why I started like listening to books instead of reading them, because I found that I was able to focus more for longer stretches of time. But then even when I'm listening to a great book, I'll have to go back and re-listen to like that same 3-minute stretch like 5, 6, 7 times in a row before I really listen the whole way through.
Right, right.
And it's amazing how much ADHD, I'm just self-diagnosing, by the way. No one's told me I have this.
Yeah.
So I think what we need are drugs.
Well, I did take Adderall for a while. But then,
did it help?
It did actually help, but then it causes, you know, it makes your blood pressure sky high.
And that sucks.
Yeah, yeah. It's because it's like I was doing this kind of a remote comedy bit, and the Adderall that I got, it would be generic. And so the bottle would just say amphetamine. Like it's like my name and my address and, you know, CVS and amphetamine. And I had to go through security once shooting a bit at like a Marine base. And it was, you know, it was like in my bag. It's just a bottle marked amphetamines, you know. But yeah, I ended up stopping doing it because just because of blood pressure, it's like, I can't be doing that, you know?
That's a deal breaker. But I imagine that there's like, and you never want to eat cheeseburgers again or some kind of benefit to it that might balance that. No, it doesn't affect the hunger so much.
No.
Probably you can't sleep very easily if you're rocking on Adderall, right?
Well, I only took it as directed. And occasionally I took, like, whenever I have taken, like, too much, I don't like pills. Like, if I've taken, like, doubled up on Adderall accidentally, because, like, I took it, and then ADD, forgot that I took it, and took it twice, it feels off. I felt awful. I felt, like, just nervous and shitty. And it's the same thing, like, whenever I've had surgery and they've given me OxyContin. They gave me that a couple times, and I hated the feeling of that, and then gave me nightmares.
Speaking of OxyContin and great television shows that you haven't seen, Dope Sick.
Okay, I've heard about that one. Is it good?
Yes, because fucking Batman, original Batman, was so good in it.
Oh, really?
We're talking about Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton.
Dude crushes. He's such a good Adam actor.
West. I thought you meant Adam West.
Oh, you're right. He is the original.
Yeah, he sure is.
But, you know, motion picture, big screen.
Yeah.
He's so damn good. Everyone's so good in it. And it really gets to the heart of the insidious nature of OxyContin and the money that was made by the family, the Sacklers.
Yeah.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
What was it about show business that first grabbed you?
You know what?
Because you grew up out here. You grew up in L.A.
Well, this is getting dangerously close to the three questions.
That's the idea.
Okay, so here we go. We're going into phase one right now.
We are. We got the initial stuff over with.
I like to put the chapter headings when I see them coming.
Okay.
Up in neon lights. Chapter one, question number one.
Yes.
Where did Jack Black come from?
Yeah. What is Jack Black's origin
story? My initial pull. Yes, the origin story, the pull to the industry. Well, my first memory of putting on a show was in the living room of our house in Hermosa Beach, California. Just south of Los Angeles, just outside of Hollywood, but close enough.
Beachy.
That you could feel the energy. Beachy, yes.
Yeah.
But you could feel the energy of Hollywood, the machine, the center of the entertainment universe, right next door. And my parents were progressive aerospace engineers. They worked at TRW, and they were very smart, but they were also folk dancing, Middle Eastern folk dance enthusiasts. That's how they actually met.
Really?
They met folk dancing, and then I was like, oh, I'm an aerospace engineer. What? Oh, my God, me too.
Let's get married.
They got married, and it was a groovy time, you know, in the late 60s, and I was born in 69, and they moved to Hermosa Beach, California, and my earliest memory of putting on a show, we were in the living room. It was me, my mom and dad, and I wanted to recreate my birth. I think I must have been like 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah.
And I put a blanket over my mom, and I would come out of the blanket crying, and then I wanted them to play their part and be like, oh, a baby, we love you, oh. It was very strange, but I really got a kick out of that recreation. And then that evolved, and I started doing a show for them, just for them. They were the only audience members where I am born, and then I grow up, and I have like a life as an adult, and then I die. I did my whole life for them, a one-man show.
Right, right.
And they just got such a kick out of it. They thought I was so funny, and I guess that was the beginning.
Yeah. How long was that? I mean, do you remember what your adult life was like in the one man show? Like, what did you do in the one man show?
It's very foggy.
Yeah.
There's a lot there. Yeah. I don't remember. I think that I graduated from school, and then I think I was driving a car. I don't think I had like
a job.
Yeah. I don't remember getting married or anything in my, I wish that there was a tape of that very first Jack Black performance, but It's really lost in the sands of time.
Yeah,
I could call my dad and ask if he remembers any of it, but for sure his fog is thicker than mine.
Yeah, that's when I was a little kid, I avoided going to bed by doing Carol Burnett bits, recreating Carol Burnett bits for my grandma.
Yeah.
And she would become incapacitated with laughter.
Oh, my God.
And it was like, that's just fucking power. Like when you,
dude, there's no more powerful sense of confidence that you can get than when you're a kid doing it, trying it out for those early times when you're trying to put on a show. If you've got a family member or someone who's just loving your shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it can be overstated how much that can carry you through the rest of your life.
Yeah. And it is like, it's, you know, you don't want to look at it as being like completely transactional, you know, like, hey, if I do this, you're like, if I push this button, I get some candy. But it is kind of like, it still does sort of have that aspect, no matter how long you do it or in what venue, it is still kind of like, well, if I go do this, I get this good feeling, and you know, I like that good feeling, and you know, it's pretty fun to make people happy. You know, it is. I have said before, it's the physical manifestation of happiness. Like,
yeah,
it's like in terms of like the short term goal of like, or the, you know, like the very succinct goal of making people happy in life, like. They're making the noise that mm-hmm. happiness is, you know, like you're making them make that noise. So
well, it's like, you know, when you're very young, when is the first time you feel that pull to have a purpose, to have something that you are good at so that there is a meaning for you to exist?
Right.
That's what we're talking about. These are big, heavy things, you know, and when you first put on a show, there's that hope like, wait, maybe this is why maybe this is what I'm supposed to do. And if you have some success in that, just like in anything, if people like what you do, if you like you're a carpenter and you made some cool like little fort, that sense of accomplishment or a job well done is one of the most powerful things that a young mind and young person can have. And mine, yeah, was definitely from a very early age. It was putting on a show was a main thing. I mean, I had other stuff I liked to do. I like to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And you know,
and
I
you
got
still
a little,
draw a lot. Yeah,
I still draw. I got some love for that. But yeah, there's something about getting those giggles and those chortles that was extra special.
Did you ever bug your kids or bug your parents because you were, you know, in showbiz town, like to be a child actor of any kind? Like,
I remember, yeah, I was jealous of other kids. Like, there was one kid in particular who was in that movie Real Life by Albert Brooks. And I was like, oh man, if I could have that. And my stepfather, many years later, when I was like 10 years old, said he could drive me around to auditions if I wanted. I was like, yes, I do want that. And then he took me around. And so I did that circuit as a young child actor. Look, I have to confess, Andy, I was a child actor.
Oh,
okay.
No.
Are you happy? Oh. Now you know.
Now we know where the damage is from. I wish I could hug you.
I loved it. And I loved going on auditions. I really did. Even if I didn't get the part, if I got a laugh in the audition, I was just high all day.
Yeah.
And I'd go on auditions for commercials, everything. There was no pickiness. It was like anything and everything. And I got a commercial. That was my first professional paying job, and I got into the SAG union when I was I think I was 12 years old. 1982, that would have been like the same year that Jeff Bridges was in Tron.
What?
Yeah,
wow,
that's how far back I go in the industry.
The ascendancy meets.
I also went on auditions for plays.
Yeah.
And I weirdly auditioned for a play called Inside Eddie Binstock. And it was playing, it was in a coffee shop in Hollywood, a crack in the wall place called the Deja Vu Coffee House. Definitely not there anymore. And it was directed by a young, fresh out of UCLA, Tim Robbins.
What
who is the world famous Tim Robbins from Escape from the Prison movie that everyone loves.
Yeah, sure.
Rita Hayworth.
Shaw Green Mile.
And the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
So anyway, he directed that, and I just looked up to him, and I was, 12 or 13.
Yeah.
And I did that for a while, and then I did theater in high school, did a lot of musical theater. So that was like the beginnings of Tenacious D, is, the mixture of music and comedy and theater. And then I went to UCLA. I was a theater major at UCLA. Not a good student. Mm-hmm. My parents didn't, bribe anyone. There was no, there was definitely some strings were pulled because I did not deserve to be at UCLA, but mm-hmm. I got into UCLA theater and I slept through all of the lectures. I was kind of going through the motions because my dad really wanted me to have a diploma. So I had to try. And then I basically bailed on college and I went off to do theater with the Actors Gang company, who was started by Tim Robbins, who I had this connection to from 10 years earlier when I was 12 years old. And we went to the Edinburgh Theater Festival and that's where me and Kyle first met to start Tenacious D, my rock band, comedy band.
You met in Edinburgh or you met at the Actors Gang?
We met in the Actors Gang.
Yeah.
And we were both in Edinburgh together. That's kind of what led to my first movie role, was Tim's first movie that he directed called Bob Roberts.
That's the first place I remember seeing you. And I have
you saw my first role.
I did. And I remember seeing you in that, you making an impression, and then seeing you in subsequent things and going, oh, that's that creepy guy from Bob Roberts. Cause you played you basically played the precursor of all the fucking, dead eyed right wing people on the internet now. Young maniac, shaved head, Travis Bickle, Republican guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before there was MAGA Nation.
Right, exactly.
I predicted it with my performance. Bob Roberts.
Do you think you caused it?
Bob Roberts could have been. Yeah, that would be a cool one for Tim to do a sequel to Bob Roberts, because it seems a lot of that has come true in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
The manipulation of the religious right into, crazy political power.
Yeah. Well, do you have any regrets about skipping college? Like, do you wish you had? Like, is it going to be hard for you to tell your kids, you better go to college?
What would have happened in a sliding door universe where, I do think sometimes what I coulda, woulda, shoulda done after high school when I graduated was not go straight into college.
Yeah.
Take a year off, travel, experience life in a different way, and then maybe go to college and really dive in headfirst with what I want to study. But then I realized, no, it's just actually not for me. Mm-hmm. And it started even before college. In high school, I had a real tough time, even in grade school, I had a real tough time concentrating, back to the ADHD. And my mind would wander in class, and it was almost like I had narcolepsy in any kind of school environment. Whenever it felt like traditional education, I fell asleep, and I fell asleep all the time. And one time, the teacher at high school, I was at Crossroads School for the Arts and Sciences.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was in 11th grade. The science teacher, chemistry, got so sick of me falling asleep in class, he told the whole class, everyone stay totally quiet. Now leave everyone, because the class is over. Instead of everyone getting up and loudly leaving, yeah, everyone left the classroom super quiet. So I was still sleeping on the desk. And then he told everyone coming in for the next class, everyone come in quiet. Jack's asleep and I want to surprise him. So everyone came in and sat down and the class started. And at some point I like woke up and looked around and I was confused because I didn't, I'm not in class with any of these students. These are all seniors. What am I doing here? And then the laughter began. And they all laughed and pointed at this silly sleeping boy.
Oh.
And the professor was most filled with laughter and glee, red-faced and pointing. And I deserved it, you know, but also maybe I didn't deserve it.
No.
Maybe there's a reason I was sleeping. Not just laziness, but some people take in information differently.
Right.
And some people shouldn't go to college.
He never slept again. you're right. That's kind of shitty. To prank a kid and make a kid feel embarrassed in front of a bunch of people. I think they should teach you in teacher's college. Don't ever do that. Don't ever humiliate a kid. Like that's just. It's just the worst, you know?
Yeah.
And it happened to me a couple times and I still think about it. It still is like a fucking, you know, finger on a toothache, you know? It's just like, ow.
Yeah.
Every time I think about it. But, you know, you got to remember too, they're high school teachers. There's you see them, like I see them with my kids, going through high school. I see the teachers that kind of are, you can tell they sort of get off on the fact that they're like pretty cool in relation to these children, you know, you know what I mean? Like I'm pretty suave and sophisticated compared to these 15-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But when it comes to like the lessons and the things that I took from school that I remember, I don't remember any of the actual nuts and bolts, but I do remember when my English teacher was like, look, you're not doing well in this class. Here's what I want you to do. So you can get a passing grade. You and Shannon, another actor student in my class, you guys go and learn this scene from Sam Shepard's. What was
True
that
West.
Play?
True
no,
West.
It was the one with the two lovers that had a tumultuous relationship. Fool for Love.
Okay.
Do a scene from Fool for Love and bring it into class and perform it live. And if you do it well, I'll give you a passing grade in the class. And me and Shannon went and rehearsed at her house this scene. And we rehearsed the hell out of it. And then we came into class and we kicked so much ass. And I was so thrilled with the performance. And then he was like, stay here. I need you to do this performance for the next class that's coming in. He loved it so much. He wanted all of his students to see it. And I just learned so much from that performance. What a great teacher.
Yeah, it was great.
And I, that's a core memory for me. It was a great lesson in how I take in information and how I actually learn on the job so much more than studying it in the book. And that guy, you know, this is a weird name droppy thing. I can't remember his name, but I do remember one thing about this teacher. There was a great English teacher. He was the youngest kid in the Partridge Family. He was that actor.
Oh, wow.
He grew up and Wikipedia.
I can picture his face, but I can't, you know.
But he grew up and became a great English teacher. But
wow.
And there's a few things like that throughout my schooling where I think about, oh, yeah, but that's where I really learned a lot. Oh.
Brian Forster.
That's the one. Brian Forster. Shout out to Brian. Great teacher.
Great teacher. Yeah. And do you think that part of like, and I'm just curious because Is there something about a teacher? Was there something appealing about it? The fact that this teacher took you out of the mainstream and tailored something particularly to you? Like, was that the beginning of what was special about it, do you think?
I think he just gave me a chance to communicate a powerful emotion and what great writing can be and what it means to put on a show with great writing. It's yeah. like it's an essential part of the work. The Sam Shepard thing on the page is one thing, but when you have an actor who's really feeling emotions connected to it, it transforms it into a whole different experience and brings the piece to life in a way that it has to be to experience it properly. You know, like,
yeah,
you can read Shakespeare till the cows come home, but until you see a great performance of it, that's the thing, the final essential piece to communicate what's happening inside of it.
Yeah, see, I'm not a big Shakespeare fan.
Oh, man.
It's lost on me. I read it. I've seen it. I've seen real big, great productions of it, and I just don't get it.
I guess you haven't seen Henry V. Yeah,
I guess I
that one will change your mind.
All right. I'll be right back.
With what's his name? He did a great job.
What's his name?
Yeah, he's a British guy. Come on.
Oh, one of those British guys. Sure.
And he has that speech in there.
Brian Forster.
There's a famous speech in there.
My horse.
St. Crispin's Day.
Oh.
Everyone, we're going into battle. And if you care about forsooth, thy shall say St. Crispin's Day. Something like that.
Something like it's. Yeah, I get the gist. I get the gist.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
In the research that somebody else, I don't research this stuff myself, there was something about Anne Bancroft giving you great notes after a high school thing.
That was a big one for me.
Yeah.
So Anne Bancroft's son and Mel Brooks' son together, Maximilian Brooks.
Who has been a guest on this podcast.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, because now he's, you know, like he wrote all those zombie books. Did you read any of his zombie books? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a brilliant writer. And now he's like, you know, goes around, lecturing and consulting about like disaster, you know, contingencies.
And he's consulted he's consulted by the military about possible scenarios because he's able to, you know, creatively imagine horrible things in science fiction future.
Yeah.
But also you'll see him sometimes on the Real Time with Bill Maher.
Mm-hmm.
And you gotta be ready with Knives Out to go on that show because sometimes Bill will turn on you and you gotta be ready with your shield.
Right.
Because he'll gut you in front of millions. And he has no fear because he can hold his own with anyone on any intellectual level. And I'm very impressed with him.
Right. And he also has the invincible quality of not giving one shit whether you like him or not.
Nope. Yeah.
Like, he does not care at all about not being liked.
You know, like we were saying about how powerful it is when you got loving parents that actually really dig you and give you encouragement early on. I have no doubt that he got that from Anne Bancroft, because I'm not her son, but I got
a
little.
I meant Bill Maher. I was talking about Bill Maher. I thought you were talking about Bill Maher.
Switched.
Oh, you switched. Okay. All right. Because I was like, I didn't mean that about, I'm Max, I think, wants to be liked. And my impression is that it doesn't, he is human and wants to be liked. So, okay.
Yes.
Anyway, gone with Max and his mom.
No, Bill Maher, I would suggest, has the opposite. He thrives on not being liked. He gets a little charge out of it. He gets a little sexual charge out of it.
Mm.
Oh, you don't like what I'm saying and you don't like me? Well, fuck you. And then people love him for it. And there's a weird
slide whistle. Because he's getting a little bit of wood. A little bit of hate wood.
But, so Max Brooks had rad parents who were loving and supporting of him. But beyond that, I was in a play at my high school called The Miracle Worker. Famous play. Helen Keller can't see or hear or speak. And she is kind of brought into this world through communication that all the doctors said was impossible by this miracle worker. Who was played in the movie by Anne Bancroft brilliantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're doing a play of The Miracle Worker, and Anne comes down. She doesn't have to do this because Max is not in the play. She just comes down because, you know, she was in the movie and she said, hello, I heard you were doing this play. I wanted to come and say hi to the cast and tell you all, you know, a little bit about my experience in that movie. And it was just so sweet and wonderful and gave us a little insight as to how we would perform the show. God dang it, I'm getting a phone call. I forgot to do the thing. Let me turn that off and do not disturb.
Was it Biden?
It was Joe Biden, my best friend Biden.
He can wait.
So she comes to the show and is so sweet, and she comes backstage and tells everybody what a great job we all did. And she said, you know, you played the role that everyone said was a thankless little role, a nothing role, and you really brought something to it. And I was like, oh my God, thank you. And then I got home and she had left a message on our answering machine at home, and she said, Jack, I didn't want to say this in front of everyone, but born to do it. You were born to do it. And it was so moving. And I listened to that answering machine message until it wore out the tape cassette. It was like 150 times. And I made a tape of the tape. And it's just weird how sometimes a little word of encouragement can mean so much and take you to another level. Just that boost of self-confidence that I got from that was, I can't really overstate how much it meant to me.
Yeah.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. That's honestly, I bet that's probably that makes it okay to not go to college. You know, I bet, you know, it's probably like one of those things where you've always got that in the back of your head, you know, because, and also too, when you want to be an actor, college, you know, it's like, I always feel like you learn so much more by doing than studying, and especially in acting. Especially in film and television, you can do a million classes, but you learn more from like 3 days on an actual professional set acting and actually learn about what it all really is and how to do it and what's important about it. You learn so much more by just getting paid to do it and being in a professional atmosphere with other professionals, you know.
It's a high wire act, and there's tons of adrenaline involved.
Yeah.
And there's no classroom that can really recreate that kind of environment. Yeah, I would go off and do a play with my friends outside of the school in front of real audiences, and I grew leaps and bounds and got so much more out of that experience than any of the classes that I had, truth be told.
Throughout, you know, as you progressed in this work, how do you deal with self-doubt? Because it's it's almost like a necessary, accompanying feeling to, like you said, it's a high wire act, and high wire acts involve falls, and there's always a fall that could be right around the corner.
Yeah.
Not that high wire acts have corners. It's usually just one straight line, but you get the idea.
Yeah. Self-doubt is a demon that must be faced. And in fact, I get it before every performance, even if I'm feeling real confident about the material or about, the song, if me and Kyle are going to go perform some music somewhere. I just, it's a kind of a running joke that I have with Kyle Gass of Tenacious D. Before we go on stage anywhere, we always, we look at each other with terror and we're like, is there some kind of a loophole? Is there some way we can cancel the show and blame it on something? Blame it on the loophole?
Yeah.
And because no matter how much we love it, there's always that little bit of dread right before you go on stage because there's a fight or flight aspect to performance, to live performance, where you really want that attention and you want that love and you want to put on a good show and make everyone laugh and have a good time. But it also is just a big crowd of people and they could judge you and they could conceivably turn on you. Mm-hmm. And there's always that little tiny seed of fear that you're not going to be accepted and you're not going to be liked. Or maybe you're even afraid that, what if I'm nervous when I go out there? They'll sense my nervousness. It's like they're a big wild animal. If they sense your fear, then they'll kill you.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's irrational. It's like, no, that's just... I have to just remind myself, no matter how bad, you'll wake up someday and you'll get, this doesn't feel like a good day. Feels like a bad show day. Feels like today is the day that I go out and shit the bed. No matter how much you feel like it's gonna suck, you have to admit to yourself, it's possible that it could go well.
Yeah.
You know what? It's actually possible that I'm gonna go out there and have a great time. As hard to imagine as that is. And then once, if you can like convince yourself that it's possible, not that it's definitely going to be good. That's off the table.
Probably.
No.
Yeah. Just possible.
There's a small chance that this could turn out well. And more often than not, it does turn out well. It's just a weird thing that you have to fucking talk yourself into. Isn't that weird? That's why really to do this, you have to love it so much, that feeling of when it goes well, that it's worth all of the anxiety and ulcers and nausea and nightmares that go along with it, because it ain't easy.
Yeah. It is really, really fun. And to me, it's more, because I got, you're used to like a much more higher energy performance than the things that I've been doing for the last 11 years or so. Going on the Conan show is like, go out there and crack wise. I would have bits to act in that I would feel a little charged up about and hope that they went well. But we did so many of those shows that we did such a volume business that I was never too precious about any one of them, mm-hmm. So I got, and I was very, for me too, it's also the place that it's at. If I'm comfortable with the place, I'm comfortable. If it's a new place and new people, then I'm like, oh, fuck. I think I might suck. I think that this has all been a trick on me, like making me believe I can do this. I do think that I forget what my point was.
I've been waiting for my turn to talk for a second here because that your bits are funny and all of the things that you guys have done over the years have always consistently made me laugh. But the thing that blows my mind about you is you're off the cuff, like crackin' wise. Just in the flow, improvisations, or just like things that you'll notice and you'll say. And I always go, man, what a mind. And I'm always blown away by the brilliance of your just in the moment things that you say.
Oh, thank you.
And that can't really be planned for. That just has to be you just actually relaxing in the moment and making observations.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, I was on Justin Long's podcast and we talked a lot about it. And it's a kind of not caring that's not the same as not caring. You know, it's like not giving a shit, but it's not giving a shit. It's giving yourself the freedom to just kind of be in there. And a big thing for me always too was like to pursue my own fun within the moment, like to be myself and to have a good time the way that I wanted to, regardless of all the stuff going on around me. Like I wanted to have fun and I always felt like that was a good sort of MO in order to ensure that the audience would have a good time too. And I mean, it's like why one of my favorite, like truly one of my favorite things was when we'd have animals on. Like just like for me, that was like, yeah, I like doing comedy bits and stuff, but I get to pet a baby tiger, you know, that's the culmination of a lifetime's work is petting a baby tiger, you know, or look at this giant tortoise, you know, like you can touch him and stuff. That's the shit that really mattered to me because I still just like, I really am like, I try and just, I don't know if it's like I try. I just kind of like, I like what I like and I follow what I think is fun. And I think too, what I was going to say was, when you say you got to really like it and to put up with that anxiety, my anxiety isn't so much in that moment. My anxiety is in the larger scheme of how am I going to make a living in all of this? How am I going to sit here when the phone hasn't rung, you know? And I had 11 years of steady work through the last stretch with Conan. So I'm back to that. And that's the part where it's like, yeah, I really do enjoy this because this is stressful. This is stressful, not, you know, like where it's like, well, another day went by where I didn't earn any money, you know? And you're like, as you get older, those matter, you know? And so but it's the same thing. It's like, I still love doing this enough that like, I'm willing to stick it out. I mean, and at this point, I'm like, what am I going to do? Get a realty license? I don't think so. You know, imagine having to sell realty at this point.
There's always porn.
I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Someone would pay to see us get it on.
A BBM. Big, beautiful man. Bear stuff. It's always, I remember once, Andy Daly and I went to Disneyland once. We took our daughters when they were little. Yeah. And we just happened to go on Gay Day. And on Gay Day at Disneyland, everybody was, like all the gay people wear red. And I think I had a red shirt on and I think his daughter had a red shirt on. So people just were looking at like these two blonde men with their two blonde daughters and like, Tons of moms coming in going, are you putting sunscreen on them? Like, you know, like they just assumed us to be stupid gay dads that don't know how to. But we went to, there used to be this all you can eat barbecue chicken and ribs restaurant that was like, you know, based on, I think, Song of the South. Like, again, that racist, the racist bears, you know. And it was, it's not there anymore. I think that, but. It was like,
that right next to the bears, the country bear jamboree?
And the petting zoo. You know, like, and you know how there's like a little theater up in the woods, you know, kind of by Thunder Mountain Railway?
The log jammer ride was all Song of the South.
Exactly, exactly. So it was right there and it was good food and they would just bring you like literal buckets of ribs and chicken. And I saw an entire like table of like 12 bear gay men, you know, big burly gay men, and they were there at like 11:15 a.m. to, you know, to just power down. And I was like, the efficiency of that, the efficiency of being a big gay dude who just is into big gay dudes. Like, yeah, let's go eat four buckets of ribs and like no judgments. Yeah. We all both are like, oh, that's so fucking hot the way you're putting away those ribs. Yeah, you too, buddy. You know, I was like, oh man, that's the life. That's the life. That is, only.
Yeah. It's a little slice of heaven.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now with Tenacious D, you guys are so fucking great. Did you ever think like, okay, it's just going to be the D for me. You know, it's just like acting, schmacting, you know, like was there ever a point where you just like, maybe I should just really focus on being in a band?
I've always felt like I needed to do more than just music, and I needed to do more than just acting. I really, from the very beginning, like musical theater, that was the great combo. But no, I've never felt like I want to just do one thing or the other. No, yeah, I'm too squirrely.
Yeah,
I'm more of a jack of all trades, master of none.
Yeah,
but we definitely enjoy doing it. But we work in bursts, and we have a slow process. We'll write a record, and we'll tour that record for a couple years, and then we have to take some time off to get that hunger again. We need 6 years between records, so that's just sort of been our process. Yeah. If we had to put out a record like a normal band every 2 years, I don't think we'd still be doing it.
Yeah,
but we do have a plan for another record, and I'm excited for it. But yeah, there will be no D wine until it's D time. Mm-hmm. And I need to get like other gigs going in between those 6 year records to feed the beast inside my soul.
Yeah.
Yeah. I need different things. But I know if I had focused all my powers and energies on Tenacious D, maybe we could have been more successful.
Right. You could have like been like U2.
Exactly. We could have been Pearl Jam.
Yeah. They could have put your album on iPhones, whether you wanted it or not. That is success. You know?
No, I don't think so.
Have you ever done any have you ever done any like Broadway musical theater? Because you have such an amazing voice.
Thank you.
You're such a good singer.
Like, you know what's weird? Somebody
put you in Guys and Dolls or something.
I just realized where I got COVID. Right when you said that. We took a family vacation to New Jersey and New York Broadway, and it was on that trip. At some point, I got COVID.
Mm.
I don't know if it was when I went to see The Music Man starring the great Hugh Jackman.
Mm.
Or if it was at the pizza place. We went to John's Pizzeria right afterwards.
Right.
Delicious pizza, by the way.
Yes.
But filled COVID-y. With
COVID. Yeah, COVID-y.
It was somewhere in New York City. Someone sneezed at me. I don't know where and when exactly. But
yeah.
I wouldn't trade it for the world. That was a fun-ass trip. But I ever done Broadway? No, yeah. I've never done Broadway. Broadway. I did off-Broadway. I was in a little play. Based on Bertolt Brecht's poetry.
Ooh.
That almost no one saw, called Bert Sees the Light.
Mm.
And I have dreams of going on old Broadway. And I was definitely jealous of Hugh Jackman while he was up there. I was thinking, that should be me as the Music Man. Well, we got trouble. And I wanted to do Music Man. I'd always thought, man, Music Man should be my entree to Broadway.
You would be fantastic. Did your wife have to like keep holding your arm and keep you from brushing the stage?
Yes.
I gotta get up there.
Dimmer down, Jack.
Jack, no. Stop it.
And I did enjoy, whenever I see great Broadway musicals, I think, God, that would be a fun life. I saw an incredible production of Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. That's probably my favorite musical theater production or piece that I think has ever been written. That dude was something special. What's his name again? That dude that wrote that?
I don't remember.
Stephen Sondheim.
Oh, yeah, Sondheim.
Genius.
Yeah.
The Demon Barber of Fleet.
I don't know Sondheim that well. And,
well, that's the one. I'm going to say that's the one. If you're going to do one, do that one. It's the darkest and the juiciest. Right. And the harmonies are insane.
The murderiest. Yeah.
And you know which other another one I loved? I love The Producers.
Yeah?
The Producers. Yeah. I know it was a movie. First, it's kind of cheating because it's not really a musical that came. The real musicals, you want to say, came first, and then a movie was made about, you know, after the stage production. But weirdly, The Producers should have been a Broadway musical first.
Right.
They did the movie, but they should have made it a musical because it works as a musical in a way that the movie doesn't, because the movie is a movie about a musical.
Right.
The musical is a musical about the musical.
About a musical.
And so it works, it resonates stronger on that meta, like, thing within a thing.
Yeah.
And kind of blew my mind. Yes. Did I miss Gene Wilder? Of course. And Zero Mostel? Of course. No one can replace those guys. But it just kicked so much ass. And I was also just blown away by that Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Because whenever I go, how much life do we really have left? When do you stop rocking?
Yeah.
Can you rock in your 50s? Sure. Yeah. I've seen people rock in their... Can you rock in your 60s? Yeah, barely. Can you rock in your 70s? Nope. It's over.
Yeah,
might as well die at 69.
Yeah.
But then you see someone like Mel Brooks having a fucking fifth act and blowing doors down, and then he's like 80. On Broadway, it's inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely. Whenever you meet an old person that, like, doesn't act like an old person, because you're so used to, and especially, like, in my own life, all the old people just, most of them suck. They just, are like, you know.
They're complaining.
It sucks. They don't, like, the thing to me is they close off, they get more scared, they don't get, like, more open. When it's like, hey, man. You know, I get it. It's scary. The clock is ticking, but try and force yourself open to that. Like, make it so that, like, the end, you're not like, I'm just, you know, like, where you're in the ground before you should be in the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, but yeah, no, it's great. I mean, I got to work with Robert Altman, and he was like that. Holy moly, this guy.
What did you guys do together?
It was a movie called Dr. T and the Women. It's not that great a movie.
You got to hang with Robert Altman.
I did. And he was super friendly, and he like would have dinners at his house. And then I got invited to things in New York because he lived in New York a lot of the time and got to go see screenings and stuff and parties in his apartment. God. And got to go like I got to go to his funeral. I was asked to go to his funeral, and it was a memorial service. And one thing that was really cool about that, and I wish that there was a transcript of it, but Garrison Keillor was one of the eulogizers, and he got up and he talked about Robert Altman's experience as a young man flying bomber planes in the Pacific. And they would take off from somewhere in the Pacific where it'd be 105 degrees, but they'd have to wear those, you know, like sheepskin, those shearling pilot coats, because they'd go up so high that it would be like, you know, was 0 degrees. They'd go from 110 to zero. And they flew these deadly missions. I don't remember where like the survival rate was 45%.
Whoa.
And he flew like 20, 30 of these missions at like 20 years old. And so, and made it through, and like a bunch of people died, crash landed a couple times, you know, like barely made it.
Robert Altman did that?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also never talked about it.
Right.
Yeah, that's not something you know about him.
Didn't toot his horn about it. But what was is that then he came back to Kansas City and started making industrial films and started smoking weed in people's offices and not giving a fuck about anything, because it's like, motherfucker, you're going to tell me like I can't make this movie the way I want to make it? I looked death in the face at the age of 20 repeatedly. Yeah. And you're going to tell me, like, I can't say fuck, or I can't like have nudity, or I can't do this sex scene, or I can't record multiple voices at once, you know, like, and it just, that was like, that was really, you know, it was just really striking to me and made me feel like, yeah, that's a kind of, he was a hero of mine before, like, you know, artistically. Yeah. And then as I got to meet him, I just was like, this is, you know, and he had his family working for him, like a bunch of people on his kids and different family members worked for him on the set. And they were all capable professionals. But I was like, that's how to do it. Like the way he's
that puts
it.
A whole other spin on MASH, the movie that he directed that led to the TV series that ran for years. And is it true? Tell me if this is a trivia thing that you're aware of, that his son wrote the lyrics to the theme song of MASH.
I think he did. I think one of them did. Yeah.
And they're not on the TV show. You don't hear any lyrics on the TV show, but
I think he did. Or was it one of the Carradines?
Suicide is painless.
Or was it one of the Carradines? Or is that maybe that I'm easy? Doesn't matter.
Whatever.
Yeah.
The thing is, folks, that story blows my mind, and I have a connection to that story because my first movie, Bob Roberts, that I was telling you about, Tim Robbins directed, went to the Cannes Film Festival. And I was not invited because I had such a small part, but my dad lived in Cannes at the time. And I was like, Dad, I'm coming to Cannes to visit you. And then really I was sneaking into the premiere of Bob Roberts in Cannes Film Festival and had the best time after the screening premiere in Cannes. Tim was like, come Jack, come to, we're going to the top of the mountain. We're going to have a little after premiere party. And it's nighttime at the top of a mountain in Cannes at some rich guy's mansion. And I'm out on the veranda smoking a joint with Robert Altman, Tim Robbins, and Giancarlo Esposito, who was also.
Wow.
And it was an incredible memory and a moment that I was just like smoking a joint with legends.
Yeah. Yeah. And every night after work, because it was very important to him that everyone watched dailies. So when you were done shooting, and they were very, very like humane hours, you know, like 8-hour days, 9-hour days.
Yeah.
You'd all get together in this big screening room that one of his sons perfected screening rooms, like the right angle and the right projector and the right distance. And we would watch it, and there'd be snacks, and he'd just be smoking joints watching it, you know. Or on weekends, he'd have parties at his house, big, you know, like big dinners for the cast and stuff. And he'd be watching, this was in Dallas, he was in a rental house, and he'd be watching like 6 different football games at once and have money on all of them. And like complicated, like I parlayed the Giants in with the Cowboys. And if the Packers lose, then the Jaguars have to win. And like all these complicated bets, just, you know, just pursued his own joy.
What an incredible life.
Yeah.
And he was at Cannes because he had directed The Player.
Yeah.
A brilliant movie about the Hollywood industry that Tim was also in.
Tim is in. Yeah.
And, yeah, I always wanted to party with Bob Altman after that. Yeah. And I never got to be in any of his movies. But tragically, he did call me one day many years later and said, I think it was like actually 10 years later, or I don't know. He said, I want you to be in a movie. I want you to play this part. It's going to be an adaptation of a documentary that I really love called Hands on a Hard Body. I want to bring that to life in a movie. And I was like, I'm in. And Jack White was going to do all the music for it. And I was like, this is fucking rad. And then he died. And I was so crushed. Not only that, I was not going to be in a fucking Robert Altman movie.
Also
that, you know, this super cool, awesome guy was gone off the planet.
Yeah.
But what a life.
Yeah.
What a crazy life. You know what he reminds me of? And I never met the guy, but did you ever meet that improv?
Del Close?
Yes. The genius Del Close.
Yeah. I took classes with Del.
No shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did they am I way off? Did they have any kind of similarities just in energy?
Yes, in energy, yes. But I mean, Dell was brilliant and a great teacher, and really, you know, thought about improv and was completely devoted to it. But he was a complete mess. You know, he could barely hold together an apartment, you know.
Okay, whereas so that's a totally
Robert,
different.
Yeah, whereas Robert Altman, you know, ran movies, you know. And
right.
And, you know, and did that, you know, like, not only just directed the movie, but, like, was constant. You know, like, all his movies, he had to go get the money first. He had to go talk to, and I mean, I think the way that everything was done was that he'd go secure, like, because his movies did so much better overseas, that he'd secure all this kind of foreign money and then get the movie started and then be still trying to get money while he's making the movie, you know, like just like get enough money to start, you know, to get the balloon off the air, but then like to keep fuel in the burner. But you had to keep pushing, you know?
That sounds like chaos to me.
Yeah,
that sounds like an enormous amount of stress and anxiety, but he was able to navigate it because, like I said, he didn't give a shit.
And he had people helping
him. He'll bet the parlay on 5 different football games, and it sounds like chaos, but no, because he's a brilliant professor, he's able to navigate through, and also, who cares if it all fucking explodes and goes to hell.
It was fun.
And that's what I felt like Del Close was also, even though his life was more shambles, he was, like, in the middle of a horrible chaos, but he was able to, like, find some brilliance because he's this wizard professor at the end of the day. I guess maybe it's just because there are two old dudes with beards. Maybe that's the only reason I think of them.
Well, no, they're both kind of gurus. They're both kind of visionaries. They're both, you know, very inspirational and inspired a lot of people beneath them. So, yeah, I mean, it is similar.
That's the thing with Del Close that I'm obsessed with, is that he's touched so many great performers, and yourself included, over the decades. I don't know that there's another teacher, certainly of improvisation, that has crossed paths with so many unbelievable, talented.
Not in purely an improv comedy. No.
And I don't know that much about him. He never wrote a book. There's not a ton of footage of him, and so he's just this weird, mysterious force of nature that you hear people talk about him, but he's just sort of a mysterious figure in my...
There's somebody made a documentary about him, a Chicago guy, I can't remember his name. And his business partner, Sharna Halpern, she wrote a book, Truth in Comedy, that was kind of based on all his stuff, you know, and that was kind of like she kind of literally picked him up out of the gutter and said, you know, here's an apartment, come teach classes. And she kind of, you know, kept him alive to keep him teaching, you know? So, but anyhow, none of this is about you.
Sorry.
This is what we're here for. That's all right.
I went off track.
We've been talking a while here. How about the second question? You ready for the second question?
Hit me.
Where are you going? I mean,
No one knows where they're going. No one knows where they're going, first of all, with this question. But, you know, if I had to look into my crystal ball and tell you where I think I'm going, or I'd like to be going, I'd like to watch my boys graduate from high school and follow them and watch where they go on life's journey. And I'm definitely going to worry about them and help them whenever they let me. But I can't help but have anxiety about my boys in the dangerous, strange world ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
and I wish for them to have like love and joy and a great adventure. And I know that when I was a kid, I didn't know what life had in store, and I ended up having a incredible, lucky, fun-filled, and, you know, ups and downs. But it's a weird thing. When you have kids, you're like, if there's a crapshoot element, where you're like, you want all the great things for them, but you don't know how it's going to go, really. I remember for most of my life, I was like, I'm not having kids. It's too much stress. I remember my parents when they got their divorce, it was just like, oh, why would you want to put yourself through all of that turmoil? And
yeah,
it's just easier not to have them. But then at a certain part of my life, I was like, I want to have that in my life. I want to have a family and a sense of shared love and it pulled me into this world that now it's everything to me. And,
yeah.
And I don't know when it's right to like say, no, let them go on their journey and don't try to control them too much. Because if you try to keep them safe too much, then you're doing them a disservice.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, in the future, where am I going? Yeah.
You never know. I mean, like I have a 21-year-old son and a 16-year-old daughter. So I'm like a few years, because your oldest is 16.
Yeah, 16 and 14.
And well, first of all, I don't know if you've noticed this, but with the first one, and I even told my son this a few years ago, I was like, listen, everything that we did with you, we had no fucking clue because you're the first. Yeah. Like we don't know, you know, you're the first one that we had that was like 10. You're the first one that we had that was 12. You're the first one that we had was going to college. You're the first one that drove a car. You know, I don't know, you know, like how much do I yell at you while we're driving the car and you're fucking up? You know, like how much do I be quiet and let you learn on your own, you know? And so the first one, you don't know, you know, it's like, I'm sure somebody else made this up, but I heard it first from Kelly Ripa. Like she said, kids are like pancakes. You know, you're going to ruin the first one. But I'm dealing with it now where I've talked about it where, you know, you want to make yourself to where your kid doesn't need you. Like that's your job. It's like, to make it so that you're not like you're making an independent creature. So you're trying to avoid their dependence on you as much as you can. But there comes a time when it comes time to where like, oh, he's leaving. And you're like, oh, really? Is that really the deal now? Is that you're going to just go off then? You're just going to go and not be my baby anymore. And it's kind of like, yeah, that's what he's going to do. And it's really hard. And you got to, you know, and then like the. And also you can't do much to ensure one way or the other, you know, they're going to like. If he's going to make mistakes, he's going to make mistakes. If he's going to be like a wildly successful, he's going to do that. And if he's going to, you know, fall on his face, he's going to fall on his face. And all you can do is like be like there to like, I don't know, make dinner for him afterwards, you know, and just, you know, let him watch your cable. Because there's not a lot you can do, and you just have to. Your job, I think, my job, I feel like now I got to fill my life. Like the spaces that were filled with kid and taking care of kid and worrying about kid and you know, raising kid, I got to fill that with something else. I got to figure out something else to put in there. And that's my job. Rather than just go like, oh, this empty space. Because, I mean, you know. There's definitely, I felt in my life from, you know, like from people, adults that were from when I was a child that were like, oh, the empty space, where are you going? And it's like, well, I thought this was the deal. I thought I was supposed to go out and be on my own. And it's like, yeah, you are. Yeah, you are. And it's not, it isn't fun, but, you know, at least you have a band. You know, yeah. How your kids go off and they go to college. You can just go fucking tour with your, you know.
I like to say that when my boys leave the nest, my empty nest is just going to turn into a 24/7 gymnasium. And I'm going to get in the best physical condition of my life.
Sure.
I'm going to finally be able to focus. They're the thing that's getting in the way.
They're the ones holding me back. Yeah.
I'm always eating those snacks that I'm making for them that they don't eat. That's why.
I got all this shitty food in the house for them. That ice cream, that's for them.
And yeah, there will be another Tenacious D. I think that the Tenacious D thing, there's going to be a Tenacious D album every 6 years until I die.
Yeah.
And that will happen whether or not there's an audience, even if it ends up just being for ourselves.
Right, because, for the day room at the home.
At the end of the day, we enjoyed doing it. We enjoyed putting on a show for whoever's there, you know, if it's,
Do your boys care about show business at all?
They do enjoy partaking in different movies and music that, I'm not really part of. They're not into anything that I'm in anymore
because
that's just not cool.
No, it isn't.
But I love to watch the things that they get obsessed with. And I'm like, oh, I actually know a couple things about some of those filmmakers. So it's fun to still be able to share. Hey.
I saw that guy puke.
but there's a. Also, I'm going to probably make one more movie. Everything that I'm going to do is just the last one at this point. The future is just, I'm going to do one more thing in each category.
Yeah.
And I look forward to retiring into the retirement home because my fantasy is I'm just going to play video games all day.
Yeah.
Because I never play as much video game. I don't hardly play video games at all anymore because I always feel like, who has time? I got to get all these things done. I do look forward to the time when I don't have to get anything done.
Yeah.
I'm in the home and I'm just playing Red Dead Redemption Part 7. Maybe that's not going to happen, but that's my fantasy. And I bet you there's going to be a lot more video games in the coming years as we come to the generation, the video game generation.
Right. You'll just plug right into your neck and then you won't even have a controller. You'll just be laying like a puddle of sauce. You know, playing a video game in your mind.
Well, you remember that movie that Robert De Niro and what was it?
Kaley Cuoco.
Forget it. No. where they had the old folks home and they only responded to when you played music that they enjoyed in their 20s.
No, I don't remember.
Okay, forget it. Anyway, that's what I'm... Thank you. Awakening.
Matt just put that in the chat.
That's going to be what it's like for me, that I'm totally catatonic until, you know, like.
They put on Dio.
You put on Dio and a screen with Asteroids, the video game. And I'll be like, I'll be reactivated.
Let me add it. Yeah.
The future. Well, who the hell knows about the future?
I know. Well, what have you learned? That's the third question. I just slid right.
This is the hardest one. What have I learned?
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it last night.
It doesn't have to be profound. I mean, Padgett Brewster, one of hers was you can sharpen scissors by cutting tinfoil. Which I was like, oh, that's pretty good. You know,
I didn't know that.
I tried it. I tried it.
And that's
it
a great
work.
Thing.
Yeah.
That's a great thing. I learned the mantra before going on stage or going out in front of an audience. This is going to sound like bad advice. Always remember to pretend to have a good time. And then oftentimes that'll lead to good stuff when you're out there. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to be having a good time. But if you can pretend to, like, be enjoying yourself, sometimes it'll lead to actually enjoying yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That helps me to stay out of the vortex of terror.
Yeah. That's a pretty good one, too. And I mean, and it's a kind of a, you know, it's kind of a Norman Vincent Peale positive attitude, but it's, you know, it is true. It's, I remember, you know, I was directing a television commercial for Illinois Lottery, and they had... And that I was in too, but they had a guy from the Blackhawks, a hockey player, off to the side reading some copy for some B-roll kind of stuff for the lottery. And they said, they pulled me over because I was doing something else. And they're like, he's reading this copy. It was like an agency guy. And he goes like,
but he's really, it's just not very lifeful. It doesn't have a lot of life to it. And I went and I listened to him read it once and I said, smile while you say it. And he, because it was just going to be voiceover, like at the end of the commercials, and they were just doing it off on the side of the studio. And which is like something that, you know, I'd learned in doing voiceovers. But when you smile, it makes you sound a lot more upbeat. And he did it, and it sounded great, you know, and like it just like you put a big fake grin on your face when you're reading something, and it just makes it sound better. You know, it just makes it sound more upbeat. And it's that's kind of like in a microcosm, like that's make it till you fake it. That's like, you know, that's like just put a smile, like smile while you say it. And just, and I mean, granted, I don't mean be a Pollyanna and let bad things happen. But I mean, you know, but like just kind of in your regular life, if you're feeling like it's a little flat, you know, smile while you say it. And then it that also isn't like the gross kind of like, come on, honey, put on a smile for me. You know, I don't mean it like that. You know, it just means like, yeah, you can kind of fake it till you make it. You can kind of force a good feeling. Yeah. You know, like out of just will. And maybe you don't, but it's better than just succumbing to the darkness, you know?
100%.
Yeah.
And you only have to fake it for a second, and then all of a sudden it turns into real joy.
Frequently, okay. Yeah. Well, you give a lot of joy. I love you so much. I mean,
feelings mute.
Just so much stuff that I see, like when you, the stuff you put on Instagram, I mean, Instagram is Instagram. It's like, it's infuriating me to me most of the time. I just like sort of rage scroll Instagram most of the time. but like you do so much fun stuff that is just pure fucking joy. And it's really such a service. And I'm so grateful for your presence in the universe. And dude, especially for your presence here, man. It's really great.
Oh my God. I mean, it was a no-brainer when I got the call to be on your show. I was like, this is happening. As soon as I get a window, I'm going in.
Thank you.
Because, from the beginning, I've always loved your work, and then always loved hanging with you over the years. We've had lots of times where we've crossed paths.
Yeah.
And it was awesome to share this day, this podcast with you. And feel free, dude, seriously, feel free. Cut out all the parts where I was boringly rambling too long.
No.
Trim it.
We're going to cut out the interesting stuff.
Just fully lipo out all.
Yeah. It'll be me asking questions and you going,
Do it. Whatever you feel is right.
All right. Well, thank you, Jack. And thank all of you out there for listening. I'll be back next week with another person. Not as good as Jack Black, though.
You say that to all the podcasters. I've got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.